Welcome to the 10th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Angelica Welch. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These are premier and renowned meetings that educate community-based oncologists and healthcare professionals on novel treatment approaches for patients with cancer. The summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. In Onc Live On Air, you can expect to hear from academic oncologists on the thought-provoking presentations that they give at these meetings. The topics vary from systemic therapies, surgery, and radiation therapy to emerging therapeutic approaches in a particular disease. That brings us to today's episode. On September 19th, we visited Seattle, Washington for another State of the Science Summit on Hematologic Malignancies with faculty of the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. The meeting covered the latest updates in Hodgkin lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, multiple myeloma, acute myeloid leukemia, chronic myeloid leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and CAR T-cell therapy. Shetri Ujani, MD, a hematologist and oncologist at SCCA and an associate professor of oncology, was our first speaker of the night. She shared insight on the changing landscape of Hodgkin lymphoma and treatment decisions in mantle cell lymphoma. First, in Hodgkin lymphoma, she covered the FDA approval of frontline brentuximab vedotin for use in combination with chemotherapy for adult patients with stage 3 or 4 classical disease. This approval was based on data from the Phase 3 Echelon 1 trial, which demonstrated superior progression-free survival with the brentuximab vedotin arm compared with standard ABVD.
The study I'm talking about today is the Echelon 1 study. This is a frontline classical Hodgkin's lymphoma study for advanced stage patients. In this study, they looked at the combination of standard ABVD to a combination of AVD plus brentuximab. We know that in previously untreated advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma patients, up to 40% of patients will be refractory or relapse to their initial therapy. Therefore, better induction regimens are necessary. Brentuximab is a well-known antibody drug conjugate to CD30. It's already approved for Hodgkin's lymphoma and a number of other situations. And now it's being looked at in the frontline setting. When rituximab came on the scene, the CD20, it totally changed the future of B-cell lymphomas. As the thought was, we could do the same thing with brentuximab by adding it to standard chemotherapy. So they added it actually initially in a phase 1 study to ABVD, and while the combination was effective, there was a lot of pulmonary toxicity. So they revamped it, dropped the bleomycin, and there you have brentuximab plus ABD, and it's being compared to standard ABVD in the Echelon 1 study. So the highlights of the study is that there were over 1,300 patients randomized. The primary endpoint of the study was modified progression-free survival, which is a little bit different than the primary endpoint of most phase 3 studies, which is progression-free survival. So normally, progression-free survival flags patients who've progressed or have died. In this study, modified PFS means those who have progressed, those who have died, as well as those who had an end-of-treatment PET CT scan that was not considered sufficient by the treating oncologist. Those patients that were flagged were then referred to another line of therapy, whether it was chemotherapy or radiation. So in this study, they compared the two arms. They found that the response rates were relatively the same between the arms. The CR rates were comparable, but there was a difference in progression-free survival. The two-year PFS, or modified PFS, was 82% in the brentuximab arm versus 77% in the ABVD arm. So very small difference, but it's present. And this ultimately led to the approval of brentuximab with AVD for frontline Hodgkin's lymphoma. Now, the other thing to take away from the study, other than the approval, is that there are some toxicities to be concerned with. Peripheral neuropathy, which is a well-known adverse event with brentuximab, is something that you have to monitor your patients closely for and dose adjust as needed. Similarly, febrile neutropenia occurred with a significantly higher rate in the brentuximab arm. With the implementation of GCSF, this rate went down, but was still higher than what we saw with ABVD. So if you're going to do this regimen, just be very cautious cautious about that and consider primary prophylaxis with G-CSF.
In mantle cell lymphoma, certain strategies are starting to pick up steam in clinical trials and could eventually have an impact on clinical practice. Beyond the approved BTK inhibitors, proteasome inhibitors, rituximab, lenalidomide, and chemotherapy, agents such as venetoclax are gaining traction. While MCL remains a difficult-to-treat disease, Ujjayi explained that data from the ZUMA-2 trial, which is examining the CAR T-cell therapy, axicabtagene ciloleucel, also known as AxiCell, are eagerly awaited by the community.
Obviously, CAR T therapy has become a popular buzzword in lymphoma right now. It's being explored in mantle cell lymphoma, and so we're hopeful with that. Kite has the ZUMA-2 study, which is looking at the use of CAR T therapy in relapsed refractory mantle cell. I think it's almost too soon to say. I think we're still trying to understand how old a patient can be to receive CAR T therapy safely. We have a pretty good handle on how to manage the adverse events of CAR T therapy. And I think that'll continue to change, improve over time. But once we get a better idea of who can handle it and how to manage the adverse events, then we can have a better understanding of how it will affect the treatment algorithm. Thus far, I'm quite encouraged, but we'll see.
The newly diagnosed multiple myeloma setting underwent a shift this year with the FDA approval of daratumumab with bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone in the frontline setting. While the regimen might not have had a high clinical impact in the United States, there are other first-line regimens being explored, including daratumumab with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. Another question is, what does this mean for the role of stem cell transplant? Here's what Andrew Cohen, MD, an oncologist at SCCA, had to say.
So I still strongly feel, based on multiple randomized studies, that transplant has a very important role for patients who are eligible. At least at Fred Hutch and Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, eligibility is not just a function of age, it's a function of comorbidities, overall state of health. And so, I think I would disagree with the statement that we're trying to get rid of transplant. Maybe in the future we will find something better. Maybe new combinations of more active agents will make it so that we don't have to do consolidation with transplant, but at present, I think for patients who are eligible, autologous stem cell transplantation in first remission is the standard of care, and I recommend it for all my patients. Delayed transplant can be an option for some patients, but in general, I do recommend patients, if they want to really get the benefits from these studies that have been conducted so far. Recently, the IFM 2009 trial, those data were published New England Journal of Medicine last year, documenting a PFS benefit for transplant. A lot of the patients in the quote-unquote delayed arm, which wasn't the actual question the study was trying to answer, did end up getting a transplant. So I think until we have data to say that transplant is not indicated, I'm not sure I would tell any patient not to get a transplant.
In the relapse refractory setting, novel regimens continue to be explored. This includes bispecific antibodies, the first-in-class SINE-XPO1 antagonist selinexor, and CAR T-cell therapies, including BB2121, which has shown an impressive one-year progression-free survival. Beyond BB2121, other CAR T-cell products are being evaluated in ongoing clinical trials.
I think most in the myeloma community are aware that these therapies have a lot of promise. We're seeing patients who were very heavily pretreated with lots of therapies respond and have good responses with BCMA CAR T cells. Hopefully, we'll see some exciting data from some of the bispecific antibodies at ASH this year. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that data, because I think BCMA, I think in general, is a good target. The other modality that I think will be important is the antibody drug conjugates, and there is a drug that's currently being studied, a BCMA antibody, and I think all of them show a lot of promise for myeloma. But in the end, patients are still relapsing, and we will need other treatments after that. So I think, while it might be nice to say that, we hope that some of these treatments are cures, I think that is really premature. And I think we still need to work harder to get better treatments for myeloma patients. In the relapse refractory setting, I think finding new drugs is the biggest challenge. There's been several recent publications that have shown that in patients who are refractory to more than three lines of therapy, that outcomes are dismal. And I think we need more new drugs. We need better therapies. Cellular therapies, bispecific antibodies are all very exciting. I really see those as coming prominently into play in the next few years. But really the biggest need is more drugs and more therapies, better durability of remissions, because ultimately when you fail immunomodulatory agents and proteasome inhibitors, the outcomes grow shorter and shorter. So we need to improve on that.
Mary Beth Percival, MD, an oncology hematologist at SCCA and University of Washington Medical Center, and an assistant professor of hematology and medicine at the University of Washington, spoke with us on exciting advancements in acute myeloid leukemia. Although a handful of agents have been approved within the past year, including midostaurin, gemtuzumab ozigamicin, CPS-351, and asciminib and ivosidenib, more work lies ahead, said Percival. More FLT3 inhibitors are coming down the pike, including gilteritinib and quizartinib, which may have a potential for the FLT3 mutant patient population. Beyond this, an area researchers should turn their focus to, she said, is minimal residual disease.
So I think that 2018 is an exciting time in AML because there have been a lot of new drugs that have been approved in the past year and a half. I think they come with some caveats because we don't have a lot of information that we still need to gain in clinical trials with more patients to figure out if some of the ones that have been approved in relapsed refractory disease can be moved to the upfront setting, whether some of them should be combined with chemotherapy or not. But I think it's an exciting time in AML right now. I think the most significant therapy is the FLT3 inhibitors. So the only one that's approved right now for the treatment of AML is midostaurin, which was approved in 2017. And it's kind of a banner child, I guess, poster child for the treatment of AML because it was a very large randomized study with over 700 patients, and they needed to screen over 3,000 to get that 700 patients. So it was a true labor to get the study underway, and then to show a 10% overall survival benefit, I think, is really huge. And I think it's also really paved the way for a lot of other FLT3 inhibitors, too. So there's a lot of interest right now in some of the second-generation inhibitors that are more potent and selective, like gilteritinib and quizartinib, how those are going to end up comparing to midostaurin and whether they'll be used in slightly different settings, I think, remains to be seen. I think it's also interesting to think about whether there's application outside of FLT3-positive disease. So, for example, midostaurin is being studied in a SWOG trial right now for patients who don't actually have FLT3 mutations. It's one of the arms in the new study for older AML. So there may be beneficial effects even in patients without FLT3 mutations of the FLT3 inhibitors.
Researchers in the chronic myeloid leukemia field have been evaluating the optimal strategies to discontinue tyrosine kinase inhibitors to avoid leaving patients on lifelong therapy, explained Gerald Radish, MD. Radish, the chair of the State of the Science Summit, discussed the ENOSOP, EUROSKI, and STIM-1 trials, which all had similar outcomes, showing that TKI discontinuation is safe and feasible in select patients with CML. However, some questions do still remain. He said, which therapy should be given up front, and how does one decide to switch to a different TKI? Here's what Dr. Radish highlighted.
So right now with CML, we have really an embarrassment of riches. We have multiple tyrosine kinases that are available. So one of the key features is how do you select a tyrosine kinase up front? And then how do you monitor patients and decide when to switch therapies or not? That's a key issue. So it turns out that people who, if they've had a deep molecular response for several years, and the actual optimal timing of that is still to be discovered, but if they've been on 2 years, 4 years, and the like, if they're discontinued, about half of them will actually stay free of disease for now the longest follow-up is about 2 or 3 years. And there's really just a cottage industry of various trials. There's at least a dozen now around the world. And they basically, they're all a little bit different about how deep of a response you have to be and how long you have to be on tyrosine kinases. But no matter what, they all kind of flush out to be about 50% of people will stay free of of relapse, which is really just mind-boggling that that can be happened. There's multiple trials. The Europeans have multiple trials. In the U.S. and Europe, there's several pharmaceutical trials. There's ENEST-ND and ENEST-FREEDOM. The FREEDOM is basically patients who have started on, from the get-go, on nilotinib, and then after they've had a certain response for a long period of time, they can kind of get off therapy. ENEST-STOP is people who were on imatinib first and then just got switched over to nilotinib. And the results are virtually the same, that patients, roughly 50% will stay free of disease. The relapses happen relatively early, about 3 to 6 months after discontinuation. And if you restart patients in these trials and in every trial, about 95% of patients will get their response back again. So there really doesn't seem to be any really harm in discontinuation. And the usual time for the response to recover is roughly about 4 months. So one of the main takeaways is that we really would prefer that patients do this on a clinical trial because we think this is completely safe, but we can't really be sure yet with this little bit of follow-up. But we at the NCNN recognize that a lot of people are trying this at home no matter what. And so we've set up with some minimum guidelines that we're trying to reinforce. And it's basically that you have to be on drug for at least 2 years, and you have to have a documented response with a deep response for more than 2 years. And that means you have to have multiple tests. You just can't show up in the clinic one day with a good PCR result and say, I'm ready to go. You have to have multiple time points. And then you basically have to be, after discontinuation, you have to be able to be at a center where you can actually get monitored every month for 6 months. So once you put all those hoops together, it's actually, you're talking about a fairly small subset of patients who should be attempted to be discontinued off a clinical trial. But that's at least the guidelines as they are now proposed. So we'll see how that goes. Otherwise, the real spectrum now is going to be imatinib is generic. There's a couple of versions out there. The cost hasn't plummeted to the cost that we think it's going to be. But that's going to really change the landscape of how we treat patients, because we have to decide which patients should go on and get the cheap imatinib right off the bat, or whether we should have a strategy where we try to induce a deeper response with a second generation drug, and once we get a good response, switch over to the cheap drug for life. Because most of these people, even with the discontinuation things, when you think about how many people are actually going to get there, maybe with prolonged therapy, 40 or 50% of patients will actually get a deep enough response to even attempt that. And about half of those people will be successful, half will relapse. So really successful discontinuation is going to be actually happening in a minority of patients. So most patients, 70, 80% of patients, are going to be on these drugs for life. So it may well behoove us to at some point switch over to the cheaper drug, for life, since otherwise it's going to pile up. But the take-home message is, I think, is that we have to rethink about how we look at CML. And so when people started studying CML with tyrosine kinases, there was a lot of resistance from the pharmaceutical community because it's a rare disease. It happens to 200,000 people. So the thought was, well, how can you possibly make any money on this? And so the thing that they forgot was that if you have a drug that you have to take for life, the prevalence of disease goes up really, really fast, because now the life expectancy for a CML patient isn't 7 years. It's now 20, 30, 40 years. So the pool of CML patients becomes very big. And pretty soon, in most doctor's offices, they may have one CML if they have any, maybe two in a practice that really is interested in it. Pretty soon, this is going to be the most common malignancy from the hematological space out there by far. And so we have to really start thinking about how we treat CML and what we do about it, because even though bad events are relatively rare, if your denominator is huge, you're going to see bad events. You're going to see people who become resistant. You're going to see people who shouldn't be discontinued, but they are, and they're going to have problems. You're going to see people go into blast crisis, which is rare, but if your denominator is huge, it's going to happen. So we really have to start thinking about this as we've switched this from a short-term disease to a really long-term chronic disease, because the complications of taking care of these patients, every hematological malignancy doc is going to see more and more over time.
In the ever-evolving chronic lymphocytic leukemia treatment paradigm, safety and finding the right combination are key things that come to mind, says Mazar Shadman, MD, a medical oncologist at SCCA. Beyond the BTK inhibitor ibrutinib and the PI3K inhibitor idelalisib, others in each class continue to emerge and show encouraging data in clinical trials, such as acalabrutinib, duvelisib, and umbralisib. Even CAR T-cell therapy is being explored in this patient population with products targeting CD19, CD20, and others. Moreover, he shared insight on the impact of venetoclax and its recent FDA label update with MRD data from the Murano trial.
In the past few years, we have witnessed major advancements in treatment of patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And the main reason for that has been introduction of novel treatment agents, mainly pathway inhibitors like ibrutinib or idelalisib, and more recently, BCL2 antagonist venetoclax. While most of the CLL patients have benefited from these new agents, we have seen a major change in treatment of high-risk CLL patients, namely ones with deletion in chromosome 17 and also mutations in gene P53. In these patients, we no longer use chemotherapy agents, and this has been a major change for treatment of these patients. With all the new advancements, we are still far from perfection in these patients, which would be cure, and response rates are not as great as what we see in patients with the standard risk disease. So really the idea is to find the best sequence of these new drugs. And in the meantime, we have access to some of the new technologies for treatment of CLL, one of the most promising ones being a technology with making T cells from patients' own T cells that are active against CLL cells, and that is chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy or CAR T-cell therapy. While this treatment is not approved for CLL at this time, we're really hoping that in the next few years we'll have that available for our patients. So venetoclax is, of course, one of the novel agents. As I mentioned, we started having access to these new drugs, namely with a different class of drugs, and that's ibrutinib, which is a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which provides excellent responses in patients. But what's lacking in patients who are being treated with any of the B-cell receptor inhibitors is depth of response. And in other words, we rarely see responses that are complete and what we call without any detectable disease or MRD negative. So for a treatment that's ongoing, it may not be a real issue, because if a patient is continuing treatment and, you know, having few CLL cells in the bone marrow may not matter. But really, what we see in the clinic is the fact that patients want to have the opportunity of stopping treatment at some point. And we believe that that's only possible if you can provide a deep response, and that gives you a chance to maybe stop treatment and watch the patient off treatment. So what's unique about venetoclax is the fact that it can, in fact, provide very deep responses. So not only these patients have a very good response in terms of lymph node size reduction, we also see a good number of patients with minimal disease in the bone marrow or in the blood. And the fact is, with longer follow-up, we're hoping that in patients who had a great response, if you stop treatment, maybe you can give them treatment holidays for a long time. So I think that's the promising feature of this drug, which is unique, and you don't see that with the B-cell receptor inhibitors.
We sat down to fully focus on CAR T-cell therapy with Brian G. Till, MD, a physician at SCCA, assistant member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and assistant professor of medicine and oncology at the University of Washington. Aside from the two FDA-approved CAR T-cell products, Tisagen, Lifileucel, and Axi-cel, lisocabtagene maraleucel is also showing exciting signals in the Phase 1 TRANSCEND trial. With this regimen comes not only safety issues to manage, including cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, but financial toxicities as well. Till shared his thoughts on how well CAR T-cell therapy has impacted the hematologic cancer landscape and how healthcare professionals can overcome some of these challenges.
Yeah, so there's the two that are FDA approved, as you mentioned, Tisagen, Lifileucel, and axicabtagene, Silelucel. There's also, falling shortly behind on their heels, is lisocabtagene, Maraleucel, that's made by Juno. This is one that hasn't been FDA approved yet, but the TRANSCEND trial is a multi-center trial that's got the pivotal data for the study that hasn't been fully reported yet, but the preliminary results look very promising. And so I would anticipate that the FDA approval is going to be forthcoming at some point for that. So that's the lead contender. There are other CAR T cells in development. You know, we have some at our center. There's a fully human CAR that's being developed. We have a CD20 CAR that's being looked at. There are other centers that are looking at CD22 for ALL. CD19 loss is a big reason that patients can fail therapy or relapse after the CAR T cell therapy, particularly in ALL. And so CD22 is a CAR that's being developed to target those patients to kind of potentially go in combination with CD19 or to follow CD19 therapy for patients who have lost CD19 as the target.
Myeloproliferative neoplasms, which include essential thrombocytopenia, polycythemia vera, and myelofibrosis, continue to be a focus of research in hematology. Vivian G. Oler, MD, a hematology oncologist at SCCA, focus on these three rare diseases, honing in on the current emerging therapeutic strategies. Myelofibrosis, she said, continues to be the most challenging of the group to treat. Moreover, there are new directions with the JAK2 inhibitor ruxolitinib, which she shed light on in our interview.
I think we found that there are a number of different pathways, either in parallel or that feed into JAK-STAT signaling. And certainly we've had studies of hedgehog inhibitors, PI3 kinase, HSP90 inhibitors, as well as other pathways such as imidacloprid, telomerase inhibitors. And I think we found for some of these, we've had some interesting signals, particularly for PI3 kinase inhibitor, that are still being explored and ongoing, and we might see some exciting updates from these as well.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 10th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com, sign up for our e-newsletters, and check out onclive.com/stateofthesciencesummit to sign up for a meeting in a city near you. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and be sure to follow our page on LinkedIn. Thank you again for listening to the 10th episode of OncLive On Air.